Thank you. Begin. Today's topic is apoptosis, program cell death, all one and the same. I kind of want to begin where we left off last time, where we were talking about how after, loss of telomeres, cells go into senescence, and then they go into crisis, and then they might go into apoptosis, or if they escape apoptosis, they become immortalized and become cancer. So now we're going to just talk about apoptosis, going a little bit farther into that that whole flowchart. But also, I want you to remind that although we are talking about apoptosis in response to senescence, in response to aging, but it is part of normal development as well. And it is a sort of a balance between survival signaling and death signaling. Okay, so it's a very dynamic, very very tightly regulated process that is constantly monitored, as we'll see. Okay, and just to reiterate the point that programmed cell death, or PCD over here, does occur as part of a normal development. During a organism's lifespan, be it the housefly, be it the elegans, be it a small, very simple microorganism, but it has to be multicellular, so the elegans are the Drosophila or human being. Now, some of the examples are here: sculpting of the digits during development, and deletion of structures during metamorphosis in the fly or any organism that undergoes metamorphosis, so frogs, toads. As part of normal living from different, this example would be more of a different geography. So if you're living at ocean level, and when you move to a mountain and you start to live over there, you do undergo a change in your red blood cells, or so, because you require a higher oxygen carrying capacity at higher altitudes. But then when you move back, there will be apoptosis to get rid of those extra cells that were created as a result of living at a higher altitude. And then obviously we know all about elimination of abnormal and dangerous cells that happens most likely during an immune response or due to progression from a disease, like an infection or something. So it's normal to have apoptosis, and it is a good thing that is very tightly regulated, as we will see going forward. Different types of cell death. We thought, apoptosis was it, and as you'll see, there's more and more literature coming out about how different organelles sometimes have their own pathway. They respond to signals that are specific to them. But in terms of the types of cell death, we can broadly call them into two ways, controlled or uncontrolled. Most cell death that we do study obviously has to be controlled so that in a laboratory environment, we can create conditions to study it. Uncontrolled cell death is usually necrotic cell death. However, it is starting to appear now, going forward with newer literature, that it may not be so uncontrolled as we thought it was. Physiological cell death or programmed cell death can again be divided up into multiple different types based on this flowchart right here. There's autophagic cell death, which involves sort of like a salvage pathway where the cell will take parts of itself and recycle the components that make up that part. Autophagic cell death is again is complete demise of the cell and the parts being salvaged by the surrounding cell. Apoptotic cell death can be caspase independent or caspase dependent. The caspases are the enzymes that do carry out the process, and we'll go more into those. And then the caspase dependent cell death can be, the signals can come from two different places, and that's why they're called intrinsic pathway or an extrinsic pathway, depending on where the signal for the caspase dependent apoptosis is coming from. Again, this is a schematic to, instead of just using that flow chart to tell you, okay, this is this and this is that, this is more of a schematic to tell you exactly what's going on. It's not a very detailed picture because I kind of want to capture the bigger picture of it. So apoptosis involves initiator caspases, effector caspases, and then DNA damage, substrate cleavage, and then phagocytosis of the apoptotic body by the phagocytes that are the surrounding cells. Autophagy, on the other hand, there's lysosomal degradation here. No caspases are involved. Autophagic vacuoles are formed, so you will see these big empty spaces when you're looking at it under the microscope. And then those are engulfed by the phagocytes. Oncosis, pyroptosis, we will not go into the details of that. It's outside the scope of this lecture today because we could probably talk about for half a semester about the apoptosis, but we're not going to. But it's here, just so you know, there is other things that are just not autophagy, apoptosis, necrosis. We'll try to cover a little bit of the, and I have a couple of slides just to remind you that don't forget this is not the it and end all. And then loss of membrane integrity is the most important part for apoptosis. And obviously, necrosis and other functions too, because the cell contents have to come out, and the integrity of the membrane then is compromised. Apoptotic pathway, not the details of it, not the nitty-gritty of it, not every single protein, but the general machinery, the general, the pathway, the shape the pathway takes is conserved, and between C. elegans, Drosophila, mammals, and everything in between. The way it is there is a stimuli that tells the cell, okay, there is something dangerous coming or there's a change coming. Then there is something that senses it. So there's a sensor molecule. And then there are regulators. So SEB9 in C. elegans and BCL2 family proteins in humans, that will be the regulators that will decide which way to go, whether there's enough to do apoptosis or should the cell try to salvage and try to repair the damage or whatever it might be. And then there are actual executioners that will carry out the process. So it is a pathway. It follows a very step-by-step process. And it is very tightly regulated. And it is conserved. The core machinery is conserved. So you will find homologs of these proteins between organisms and systems. But they may not be the same, but they perform the same function. Okay, moving forward. All my slides, every time I do Google Docs, and I wasn't counting on this one being messed up, because I was counting on two of them being messed up, so I sent them separately, but this one, not so much. All right. One more for me to send you guys. I'm just going to make a note for myself here. By the way, did you guys get the other one?
I forgot to send it
up today. Okay. And I did have those other two apart from this one. I just hope, yeah, they have those ones because I know those didn't transfer very well. This is differences. So what this slide was meant to do was to sort of start in contrast and differentiate the various cellular functions that happen between apoptosis, necrosis, and autophagy. Okay? And the most important part was the genetic programming of it. Autophagy, now we're finding out it is, so it's, it's still not as defined as some of the other ones. The cytoplasm swelling, this chromatin condensation is the most important one. DNA fragmentation and laddering is the other important one. Okay? And then I'll send you a better slide. This is, I'm sure it's printed this way too. So what is apoptosis? We've talked about how conservative it is. We've talked about that there is a pathway. We've talked about there's multiple players. But what happens? It is a predominant form of cell death that is important in normal homeostatic in cells, as well as cells undergoing remodeling, undergoing disease, during disease as well. It's a sequence of events involving various classes of proteins. We'll go over them today, and we'll go through the exact sequence. It is genetically programmed and evolutionarily conserved. This figure right here demonstrates what the process looks like if you were to look at it under a microscope. The cells, these are normal healthy cells. As the apoptosis begins, the cells begin to, the cytoplasm shrinks, the chromatin condenses, and then you'll start to see blubbing. And these are little tiny parts of the cell that will still be attached, but you can see them as separate parts of the cell. And then this apoptotic body gets phagocytosed. And why should we study apoptosis? Like I said, it is part of normal development, and it is also important that the cells who are going, who are on their way to becoming cancer, evade apoptosis. So they have to overcome it one way or the other. And so it's insufficient or evasion of apoptosis is manifested as cancer and autoimmunity and viral infections. But if so, too little apoptosis is bad, so is too much apoptosis. While active-related cell death is related to neurodegenerative diseases, immunodeficiency, infertility, and obviously heme deficiencies. We're talking now about the proteins involved. Major players are the BCL2 family proteins. They can be anti-apoptotic, pro-apoptotic multi-domain, or pro-apoptotic BH3 only domain. So the structure is how these are classified based on their structure. I guess there was no other way to make sure we could figure out their function. It's actually easier and better this way, so that you can modulate the structure directly to the function. Caspases is a second group that can be divided into two, initiator or executioner caspases, depending on where they are functioning in the pathway. So the initiators are slightly upstream, effectors would be downstream, more closer to the actual disintegration of the cell. So here is the bigger one that talks about various domains of the proteins and what makes them belong to one group versus the other. So the BCL2 family proteins consists of a lot of proteins. I think there's about 22, but I could be wrong, because depending on which organism you're talking, there's a little bit discrepancy. Anti-apoptotic proteins such as the BCL2, BCLXL, BCLW, MCL1, and DIVA. So they have the four BH domains, which is the BCL2 homology domain, and these four are the ones, the presence of all four of them is what characterizes the anti-apoptotic protein. Or in other words, they are pro-survival proteins. So they are the one that acts antagonistic to apoptosis. Pro-apoptotic proteins are the multi-domain proteins, and they have BH1, 2, and 3, whereas the BH3 only is the other class of proteins. And we'll see how these are a little bit different in their functions going forward, but just remember that the domains that are present and the number of domains is very critical to their function, or at least that's how we think about it. So BH3, the multi-domain or the three domains are more pro-apoptotic, so all four are anti-apoptotic, and the BH3 only are more of the sensors. And that's what's seen here. So the NACHTA, PUMA, let's go over the list just so that we have them. It's right here. NACHTA, PUMA, BID, BIM, BAD, all of these, all the Bs. I think if there's another one, I don't know, they're going to not find a B to go with it. But these are all starting with a B. So these are the ones that are the sensors. So you see here, NACHTA responds mostly to genotoxic damage, hypoxia. BIM responds to cytokine deprivation or calcium or Taxol or UV, that kind of insult. And then some of the other ones are not very clear, but at least these, so we think of them as sensors of the insult that's being inflicted upon the cell. And then they all will inhibit the BCL2 because it's the pro-survival or anti-apoptotic protein. Now, if there is an insult, we need to inhibit BCL2 and activate the BAX so as the apoptotic machinery can move forward and then activate the caspases. Okay? So far, so good. So these are the sensors. These are the two proteins that are tightly regulated to control which way the cell is going to go. And then these are the actual proteins that will initiate the caspase cascade and continue it to go into apoptosis. The important thing to remember is there are various physiological factors that will lead to either engagement of these or non-engagement of these. And based on the activation of these, the downstream machinery can function. So now this is a pictorial. Let's think about an apoptosis-inducing signal being inflicted upon the cells, and the BH3 only proteins are NOXA, PUMA, BIM, BAD, BID are activated. They go in and bind BCL2, and then leads to the BAX and BAD. Oligomerization and going on to the mitochondria. So this is the mitochondria. They locate to the mitochondria and they go into the outer mitochondrial membrane, form a channel, and that channel is very important because it leads to activation and release of proteins that are important to carry out the next function. So these channels are there, they lead to there can be cases independent death at this point because mitochondria does secrete other factors like endo-G, which do not require caspases to do the function. And then there's caspase-dependent pathway, which then cytochrome C comes in contact with APAS-1, which then forms a apoptosome along with caspase 9, leading to executioner caspase activation, such as caspase 3. And then active caspases will lead to apoptosis. Now this slide is deliberately not mentioning any of the proteins because I want you to get the schematic first. Get the steps first as to what's happening when, and then we'll introduce the actual proteins that are in there. Okay. So since these sensor molecules are present, how are they regulated? Depending on the signal, so if there is a survival factor leading to activation of AKT, AKT is known to phosphorylate BAD, which is one of the signals that senses genotoxic or insults to the cell. When it's phosphorylated, it is sequestered by 14-3-3, which is another protein that just sequesters BAD. And now since BAD is sequestered here, it leads to survival. But if there is no survival factor and AKT is not able to phosphorylate, BAD then associates with BCL-XL and leads to apoptosis. So it is all in the dynamic regulation of who the partner is for these proteins. So they are all present in very low amounts and they are sequestered depending on the signals that the cell is receiving. Okay. Now here is a little bit more, it's the same slide that we saw a couple slides ago, so it's the same as this one, but now it has the proteins in there with their names. So that once you understand the other slide, it's easier to fill in the blanks with the actual names of the protein. So again, there is an extrinsic signal. Now in the presence of this signal, the kinases will phosphorylate BAD, which is right here. So if there is a signal, which is a survival signal, for example, because it's AKT, BAD will be phosphorylated and sequestered by 14-3-3 gamma. And BIM is also sequestered in the cytoskeleton. But when this signal is gone and there is a loss of extrinsic survival, pro-survival signaling, BAD is no longer phosphorylated, FKHR then translocates to the nucleus, leads to the transcription of BIM, and then this BIM also dislocates from the cytoplasm. BAD then goes and sequesters BCL2, which allows for BAX to become available and dimerize with BAC. Sorry, it's going to get real confusing a little bit. So then these two dimerize and form a channel that leads to the release of cytochrome C, which is sequestered inside the mitochondria, to go out of the mitochondria, combine or make the apoptosome with the PEP1 and procaspase 9. And procaspase 9, this then, the whole apoptosome then activates procaspase 9 to caspase 9. Because all of these are in an inactive form, because obviously we don't want cells. These caspase is chopping everything off when there's no need for it. So then this procaspase 9 will go further down to caspase 3 and 7, leading to apoptosis. I'm hoping this step-by-step process is making it a little bit easier. Do you have a question?
So then, or that can attach to BPL2?
Mm-hmm. Yes. So here's what we've talked about so far, just a little bit in sentences so it's easier for you to think about it. Now, BCL2 must change conformation to be activated on the mitochondria to inhibit BAX. So right here, when BCL2 is inhibiting BAX, it's actually in a conformation that allows for that to happen. And when BIM or BAD binds to it, that conformation changes again. Okay? BCL2 and BCLXL are the guardians of the mitochondria because they are holding on to BAX and BAX so that the pores don't form. These proteins are transcribed into multiple splice variants. You've seen that. BCL2 is phosphorylated by... So phosphorylation is the post-translation modification that governs a lot of the cascade that's happening. BCL2 and BCLXN can also be cleaved by caspases during apoptosis. Cleaved proteins then turn themselves into apoptotic killers. So they are become part of the machinery. So it's caspases are very very generic because they cut anything between the residues that they're supposed to cut. And I think it's their proteases. BCLXL may undergo deamidation of the asparagine residue susceptible to apoptosis by disrupting the ability of BCLXL to block the pro-apoptotic activity of the H3-only proteins. So they can go back and have a negative impact as well on the whole process. So now we've come down to the mitochondria. We've seen the signal come up to the plasma membrane. It's getting from the BAD to the BIM to BCLXL to BAX. It's come to the mitochondria. What happens in the mitochondria? We know mitochondria is a double-layered structure. It's got the outer mitochondrial membrane and the inner membrane, which is right here, the outer and the inner. It's the cristae. It helps in increasing the surface area of the mitochondria itself, which is important for electron transport chain and respiration and all of that. You guys have covered all of that in Biology 101. So, however, what's important is this little molecule, what is that? It's cytochrome C, which is part of the electron transport chain, and it performs a very crucial function. It's part of the electron transport chain in respiration. Now, it is localized on the inner mitochondrial membrane, and it is important in this complex 4 function. Okay, so that's all I want to talk about over here, that it is part of the normal thing. It is localized in the inner mitochondrial membrane, and it does its function of respiration, or actually electron transport. This is another picture saying the same thing, that it's the holocytochrome C, which is part of the inner membrane, and then it can be released. It's manufactured or synthesized as apocytochrome C, and then it comes and binds to the heme group in the holocytochrome C. Now, holocytochrome C is the one that's important for apoptosis. Similar slide, only to illustrate the point that the pore formation is a very important for allowing cytochrome C to escape the mitochondria, inner mitochondrial membrane, and move on to the outside. Okay, so the important ones, the VDAC, the TOM, TIM, these are all the proteins that are associated with the membrane, and we'll see how they come together. So here is a slide that talks about how the ONM, or the outer mitochondrial membrane permeabilization, or the permeability transition pore, or the mitochondrial fission happen so as to allow for things to leak through. Because, you know, in a normal situation, mitochondria is very, very tightly controlled. It doesn't allow for stuff to just leak up. And there is three mechanisms of apoptotic outer mitochondrial membrane permeabilization. Mechanism one, which talks about right here, is the direct OMM permeabilization. And the way it's supposed to happen, or at least it's theorized to happen, is BH3-only proteins such as BIM and BID induce direct permeabilization via Baxdin-BAT lipid interactions. That's what we saw in the earlier slides too. And then in one model, the CBID, right here, it can interact transiently via the BH3 domain with Bax by replacing the C-terminal helix from the BH3 group. Okay? So, and possibly other proteins such as DRP1 and MFN2 can do the similar thing by using cardiolipin distribution, which are all fatty acids as part of the membrane of the mitochondria. So it is an interaction between our Bax and BIM, and then BID and the Bax. So basically our sensors are coming down to facilitate this. In mechanism two, Bax here would help with the calcium. It will mobilize the endoplasmic reticulum calcium stores, which will lead to mitochondrial permeability transition 4, leading to swelling and leading to rupture of the ONM. So I'm thinking it's more to do with the calcium coming in, it's change in the charges, so and that probably affects it. Agents such as mitochondrial toxins can do this too by a similar fashion, by changing the levels of calcium. And then mechanism three is more of the fusion, and that changes how that promotes fission to destabilize the outer mitochondrial membrane, and that might leak some proteins out. Okay, now the theory right now is that all of these three mechanisms are not mutually exclusive. They can happen in any combination. Going a little bit further down, so after caspase 9 is activated, it activates caspase 3 and 7. So here, apoptosis. So this is basically going through the same stuff over. Signals coming from the outside, the sensors molecules leading to formation of channels on the mitochondria, leading to the release of cytochrome C, which next happens is the formation of apoptosome, which again now will activate caspase 3 and 7, which are the executioner caspases, which will just go, it doesn't matter who you are or which kind of protein you are, it's going to start chewing stuff up and leads to cell death. And it also cleaves BID. The truncated BID now can go ahead and start this process all over again. So it can be a loop that reinforces itself. So because of this loop that reinforces itself, some scientists do believe that release of cytochrome C is kind of a point of no return, that once cytochrome C is released from the mitochondria and this whole circle begins, the cells can't go back. Types of caspases, there are initiator caspases 2, 8, 9, and 10. Executioner caspases are 3, 6, and 7. The difference is where they are acting in the pathway, and obviously the domain structure of it. So in the executioner caspases, the prodomains are smaller, and in the initiator caspases, they are a little bit longer. Various different caspases have been recognized, and they're listed here, for and their substrates as to the proteins they act on, They're activated, the adapter proteins that are here, active subunits, and the prodomain length and motif that's important for their function. This is for your information only. It will not be on the test or anything, because this is the information you can get from papers anytime. What is important is where the cleavage occurs, and test phase 11 and 12 are mouse. Test phase 13 is bovine. I think all cast phases are of human origin. And they're phylogenetic origin. So the executioner cast phases here, the initiators here, they relate to their function. So they've evolved a certain way based, so they're more specialized to do the functions they've evolved to do. Okay? The position of the first activation of cleavage is between the small and the large subunits. And then the second one is right there. And obviously the DED is the death effector domain. And let me think if I remember what CARD stands for. The CARD domain, it's caspase activation and recruitment domain. It's important for recruiting other caspases because these are initiator caspases. They have to be able to go and recruit others to bring them together. Okay, especially when they're forming the epiphysome for caspase 9. Okay, all right, so quick question. Now we've got this machinery, and there's a signal coming, and it activates the sensors, the PUMA, NOXA, BIM, VIN, whatever, goes to inhibit BCL2, which activates BACS now, leading to the going on to the mitochondria to form these cores, leading to the leakage of cytochrome C and endo-G and other proteins that will cause caspase activation or caspase-independent apoptosis. So it looks like, you know, once this function gets going, there is no going back. Now, in any living organism, it never happens that way, right? There's always a mechanism to stop it. And, oops, did I miss it? There it is. Oh, I think I'm getting ahead of myself. Sorry. But we saw this already. I'm not going to go over it again. I'm not going to go over it. So here is the ones I was talking about. Now, IAPs are inhibitors of apoptotic protein. Obviously, they are very important because once, if there is a misfiring or if there is a chance that the cell can repair the damage and go back, then the cell wants to do that. And that's why there is these inhibitors of apoptotic proteins. These were first identified in the genome of the baculoviruses based on their ability to suppress apoptosis. So once the cytochrome C is released, it is true that it's considered a point of no return, but there are proteins that do work ahead of it to suppress apoptosis in infected host cells that were baculovirus infected. Now, several distinct IAPs have been identified in mammals. So these are the viral ones. The mammalian ones are here. So XIAP, cytoplasmic IAP1, cellular IAP2, and IAP brucervirin, and the PIAPs. And then there's some in the fly, nematoses. So in other words, this also is very conserved between the systems that we just talked about. So it is a tightly regulated process now where there are inhibitors of apoptotic proteins present. And they function by the dark shaded portion, that's the BIRD domain, which is the baculovirus IAP repeat. And it's important. And it functions by blocking the caspases or the substrates. Okay? And the other thing I wanted to mention is that procaspases that are not active yet do not respond to IAPs, it's only the processed ones. And it'll become clear when we talk about the model that has come up. So IAPs function as critical survival molecules. especially XIAP, is generally overexpressed in multiple cancer cells. So overexpressing it is a way of inhibiting apoptosis, hence allowing cells that have genetic instability to go on and on and on and make cancer. It is a very conserved protein, so, you know. Okay, what was I trying to do here? Why did it go? Oh, that's what it is. So the M is from the stimulation. I'm going to stop using Google Docs because I figured it was an easier way to transport 20 megabytes of slides. It doesn't go in an email, but it messes my slides up. So during apoptosis, the IAP's mediated inhibition is removed by mitochondrial protein. So IAPs function as pro-survival molecules. They inhibit apoptotic pathway. Now, obviously, something needs to come in and relieve that inhibition, and that's done by SMAC. It's the second mitochondrial activator of caspases, and the reason it's called the second because the first was the signal that led to apoptosis. It's also called diablo, and it has homologs in the fly system, the DIAP, and you can see how conserved it is. Okay, upon stimulation of cells and activation of apoptosis, SMAC and diablo is released from the intermembrane space of the mitochondria into the cytosol together, so right here, so it's situated right here, together with the cytochrome C, where a cytochrome C directly activates APAF1 and procaspase 9, SMAC diablo interacts with multiple IAPs. Don't have a picture for that, but that's what's going to happen. So you have the membranes, mitochondrial membrane now porous, SMAC comes out, and cytochrome C comes out. Cytochrome C goes to activate the procaspase 9, but SMAC goes on to relieve inhibition by the IAPs on the caspases.
So many of these proteins are in mitochondria. Do you know if these proteins are encoded by human genome or mitochondria?
Most of the mitochondrial proteins that are present in the mitochondria are nuclear. I used to know the number off the top of my head, how many polypeptides the nucleus, the mitochondria encodes for. At least in the ETC, there's about 7. The whole thing is, the mitochondrial proteome is, oh goodness, I used to remember these numbers, but most of the mitochondria, or the proteins that reside in the mitochondria are nuclear-coded, okay? So even in the ETC, only subunit 2 is the one that does not have any it has all nuclear-coded proteins, non-mitochondrial. ETC complex 1, 3, 4, and 5, they have like 7 proteins that are mitochondrial. Everything else is nuclear. Okay. And cytochrome C and SMAC are definitely nuclear-coded. Okay, so then IAP would go, so the SMAC would interact with IAPs to relieve inhibition on the caspases, and then SMAC functions, it works by binding the BIR domain. The SMAC will bind the BIR domain, the baculovirus repeat that we talked about, that's the functional part of it. SMAC binds the BIR domain to relieve that inhibition. And here's the one that I was talking about. Like, we're going to go into a little bit detail. So, the BIR domain and the linker to the BIR domain and the tetrapeptide IAP binding motif. So this is part of the IAP. And then this is the SMAC. SMAC with the BIR 3. Okay? So, inhibited caspase 9 is bound by the IAP right here. Now, when the signal comes in and active caspase 9 needs to be present, the SMAC comes in that's released from the mitochondria, and it will bind this and sequester it here, releasing, making sure now caspase 9 is activated. So, in other words, when there is no signal to initiate apoptosis, caspase 9 is inhibited by the IAPs in the resting or in a normal physiologic state. When there is signal and SMAC is released from the mitochondria, it's released, it binds the IAP, releases it, keeps it here, caspase 9 becomes active. And now it's fully active once these little things are cleaved by the active caspase 9. And these little these IAP binding motifs that inhibit the IAPs as well. Once that is released, it goes back in. So it's a loop, and it works. So same thing happens when, so now this active caspase 9 will go and activate caspase 3 and 7, which were again also inhibited by IAPs here. So for this figure, you start from here and look this way. For this one, we're looking this way and working our way this, to the middle. Again, so there's a feedback. Now caspase 3 and 9 will activate more caspase 9, which then, again, loops in. Okay? So this is how it's happening. And then active caspase 3 and 7 will lead to indiscriminate chopping of proteins leading to apoptosis. Any questions here? Okay. So, known apoptotic pathways to activate caspases, we just have them divided up or categorized so it's easier for us to understand. The intrinsic pathway just means that the signal that would activate the apoptotic machinery will come from within the cell. The extrinsic pathway or the DES receptor pathway just means that the signal is coming from outside the cell. There are other alternative pathways that do not fit any of these two. And then there is caspase independent apoptosis. So the extrinsic apoptotic pathway or the DES receptor pathway, obviously there is a receptor on the plasma membrane, such as the TNF, or TNFR is the receptor, TNF is the ligand that will bind it, leading to the TRAD and FAD, which are the talk in between molecules that will interact with the caspases going forward, because they interact with the so the death domain of the FAD and TRAD would interact with the death-inducing or the death effector domain of the caspase 8, which then goes through a conformational change to lead to active caspase 8. But if it's not interacting with caspase 8, then it leads to the signaling, the survival signaling, which is lost apoptosis. But if there is a receptor binding to the ligand here, then it goes through this pathway, which activates caspase 8, leading to activation of caspases 3 and 7, leading to apoptosis. CD5 ligand with CD5 receptor is the other death receptor, so it can be either of the two. Again, they both work with the procaspase 8. So extrinsic pathway works a little bit different. What we studied a little bit earlier with the mitochondria involvement is also the intrinsic pathway. And that's here, so they can talk to each other, because obviously in the cells, things talk to each other all the time. So the extrinsic pathway, the FAS ligand binding to the FAS receptor, FAD leading to activation of caspase 8, caspase 3, it can again go to this BID. Where did my BID go? Right here. BID and TBID leading to BAX activation, mitochondria, cytochrome C release, apoptosome, caspase 3 leading to death. And then again, AIF is the apoptosis inducing factor that's released from the mitochondria that induces apoptosis all on its own. And then the IAPs and the diabolos. So this is a very simplified slide, but it touches all the points, so you have an idea of what all can be going on. Again, you can put in multiple different proteins here, multiple different proteins here, multiple different IAPs here, depending on the context of where the signal is coming from, what the signal is. Okay? How to detect or how to study apoptosis? Cell morphology is something you can look at it under the microscope and see, oh, are these cells dying? Usually normal, healthy cells are very spread out. They reflect light a certain way when you throw them under the microscope. Apoptotic cells are rounded. They're not as flat. They are more shinier. And they just don't look like normal cells. You can tell. Cytochrome C release can be measured. So this is now you're starting to perform some experimental procedures on them to study cytochrome C release by immunolabeling or Western blot. So you can take the cells, isolate the cytosol and the mitochondria, so you're not looking at the cytochrome C that's in the mitochondria, but especially the ones that is released into the cytosol. So you can look at that. And Western blot for caspase is amylase substrate. DAPI stain to look at chromatin condensation, because that is one of the hallmarks of apoptosis. The other one is the annexin 5 staining. Now, annexin 5 is something that binds phosphatidylserine. Phosphatidylserine is part of the plasma membrane. In a normal healthy cell, the phosphatidylserine is towards the inside of the plasma membrane. But when the cells begin apoptosis, they are exposed to the outside. Hence, they become available to where annexin 5 can bind. Now, once annexin 5 can be conjugated with anything you want. It can be FITC, it can be Cy5, Cy3, whatever. And then you can look at it through the flow cytometry-based assay. And then the ultimate could be detection of the apoptosis using gel filtration assays. I have some pictures of these, so let's look at those. So again, so release of cytochrome C at 0 minutes. You see if you go on, it's kind of all over. The nucleus is no longer visible because this is not a section. It's just a field of an entire cell. So you see it all over. And then you can also look at it by release in the cytoplasm versus the mitochondria. So in the cytoplasm, it's starting to show up right here. And the mitochondria should go down, but sometimes it doesn't, depending on what your controls are. But you definitely see it coming up in the cytosol. So that's one way of looking at it. Caspase cleavage is another one you can use to study. So this is a Western blot-based assay. At 0 minutes, all of it is procaspases. But then as you induce apoptosis here, BMD-188 is a drug that's used. And then you see these cleaved caspases appearing. And then PARP cleavage is the other one that's a very commonly studied substrate of the caspases. With reference to DAPI, so something like this cell is normal, but this is definitely an apoptotic cell if you're looking at just the morphology under a microscope. Texas red, I think it's a mito tracker. This is DAPI. DAPI is a dye that intercalates into the nucleus, into the DNA. If the DNA is not fragmented, nice and homogeneous, it's a nice blue layer, very homogeneous. But if it is not, then you see speckles of DAPI. So that's another way. And detection of apoptosis. This involves a little bit of very specific, a very trained person to do it, because it's not that every lab does this detection of apoptosis formation, which is to say that yes, all the components are present, the machinery has gone through the signaling, the conformational changes, the pore formation, the release of proteins from the mitochondria. Now this is the last step where you're looking at the formation of that wheel-like structure, apoptosome. So these are very big molecules. The monomers are here, but if you start to see bigger molecules showing up, that's when the apoptosome has begun to form, and we know that caspase 9 is active in all of them. A few different ways to study. Okay, what happens to the apoptotic cell? We kind of covered this a little bit. The viable cells produce signals that tells the phagocytes that I am a living, healthy, happy cell. Please don't bother me. So these are called the repulsion signals, which tells the cells, don't worry. But then apoptotic signals, the cells release very specific signals that tells the phagocytes that it's time to salvage whatever you can salvage. Okay? CD31. Now, what happens to the apoptotic cell is the same old slide, just telling us the actual signals, so the IL-10 and TGF-beta, the cytokines that are released, that will bring in the inflammatory molecules to phagocytose the cell. Okay. Coming to our topic, how apoptosis affects tumorigenesis. It's frequently seen that there is upregulation of BCL2, which is a pro-survival, BCL-XL, IAPs, and downregulation or mutation of pro-apoptotic genes, such as BACs, BAC, BH3 only protein sensors, gut receptors, APAS1. So obviously, to evade apoptosis, the cell goes through a lot of effort to upregulate the pro-survival and downregulate the anti-apoptotic. And this is already seen in a lot of human cancers. Apoptosis-based strategies for cancer therapy. I think the two core places we can work on is here and the BH3 mimetic. Those are the two places that are being focused on. So the BH3 mimetics and the homologs for inhibitors that are already present. And this is sort of talking about the BH3 mimetics, because if you're in the normal cell, there is a genotoxic signal. P53 is wild type. It gets activated, leads to the expression of NACHTA-PUNA, which inhibits BCL2, leads to apoptosis. But in a tumor cell, when the P53 is mutated, there is no longer signaling to activate NACHTA-PUNA. BCL2 is also upregulated, leading to more survival signaling. And the plan or the hypothesis is that even if you have a mutant P53, but you can create a BH3 mimetic, which would do what NACHTA-PUNA does, is to block BCL2 signaling leading to apoptosis. So that's where the hypothesis is, and I don't think there is one that is clinically available yet, but there's a lot of labs working on it. Take-home message from the apoptosis lecture. It's a predominant form of cell death from worms to mammals. BCL2 family proteins make the decision to live or die. Now, BCL2 might say BCL2, but it is the entire family, which includes the pro-apoptotic and the anti-apoptotic, and also those molecules that sense the genotoxic signals. So it's the entire family. Caspases are the main soldiers in the battlefield to do the dirty work that's required to chop up all the protein. Mitochondria is the center for all this activity. Targeting BCL2 families have enormous potential, but I haven't seen anything, yeah. Finding N-terminal SMAC dialomimetics will counter the IAPs. We talked about how those could be the target, the paths or the points in the system which could be targeted. And then the application of death ligands. But then if you don't have downstream signaling, death ligands really can't do much. Other apoptosis and survival functions of BCL2 proteins. So BCL2 can also be cleaved by caspases during apoptosis, and the cleaved fragments do function as a pro-apoptotic. So again, it sort of reinforces the fact that once the cell has made its mind or it's determined that it can no longer be salvaged or go back, that it takes all its machinery and does apoptotic signaling. These proteins also undergo post-translational modification, which impacts apoptosis sensitivity. So for example, the amidation. Pro-apoptotic BH3-only proteins such as BAD, BIM, BOMA, PUMA, NACHTA have been shown to possess pro-survival roles. That is, BIM is not on here, but we were the ones who showed BIM is also pro-survival. So these functions, these do function in other pathways, so it all depends on the context and also where the cell is in terms of in the normal, or is it in the tumor cells, and things like that. Caspase activation is involved in cancer cell invasion, and caspase 8 is required by NF-kappa-B activation to promote cell motility. Caspase-independent cell death, because that does happen, CICD, caspase-independent cell death. MOMP is mitochondrial outer membrane permeabilization, so when the mitochondria, our membrane is porous and it allows for the proteins that are sequestered in there to come out, such as endo-G, such as cytochrome C, such as apoptosis-inducing factor, AIF1, SMAC, Diablo, and ONI. All of these play a role in caspase-independent cell death. We're not going to worry too much about those because it's not in part of this lecture, but it does happen. Autophagy is the other one that's a more of a survival pathway, but it can sort of lead itself into apoptosis or autophagosomes and to the demise of the cell. So we'll talk about it briefly. It was first recognized under in early 1960s under electron microscopy, also called microautophagy or self-eating to survive. It's more, the way I look at it is more of a salvage pathway. The cell will take what it can to make sure it can tide over whatever is the signal that's leading to autophagy. And it's mostly to nutrient deprivation. It's a unique form of membrane trafficking in which membrane compartments, such as autophagosomes, engulf both organelles and cytosolic macromolecules and deliver them to lysosome for degradation. And then the little bits of the amino acids, the nucleotides, whatever it is, they're used up again. So the trigger is, autophagy can trigger cell death, but it's mostly intracellular housekeeping clearance. It's normally seen with antigen presentation by MHC class II molecules. During development, it's very common. It is anti-aging. Elimination of aggregate-prone proteins is the main function of autophagy. It also eliminates invasive pathogens, and then elimination of superfluous organelles. For example, you know, somebody is exercising a lot, they've developed a lot of mitochondria, they don't need them anymore. You know, and so then they're lost this way. These are the amino acids that are created are recycled into the TCA cycle in survival against starvation. So usually nutrient signals are the ones that activate this pathway. This is an illustration of the phosphatidyl serine. Okay. So autophagy can be activated by starvation, or by growth factors, or nutrient abundance. So either way. So starvation will lead to inhibition. That doesn't make sense to me. Okay, let's see. The mTORC1 complex is central. Obviously, you can see it's a regulator of the autophagy, and it inhibits the ATG1. Which is not okay. And the mTOR will integrate inputs from growth factors, nutrient abundance, and energy status. Nutrient deficiency or low energy status, leading to high AMP concentration. So the AMPK right here will lead our drugs such as rapamycin. Will lead to mTOR to inhibition, leading to activation of the ATG1. So if rapamycin, which is an inhibitor of mTOR, will inhibit mTOR, will relieve ATG1 inhibition from mTOR and lead to activation of the autophagosome. Again, autophagy is a very specific process that happens in specific steps. Through membrane nucleation, autophagosome formation, fusion with the lysosome, formation of the autolysosome, and then degradation and then reutilization of the components. This is a little bit more detail. Again, the same process, nucleation, formation of the autophagosome, and then fusion with the lysosome. But here, this talks a little bit more about the actual proteins that are involved. They are outside the preview of this lecture, but I put it in here so that you're aware. And if you know, if you think about, okay, someday I want to think about this, then it's here for you. The most important is the LC3 and the LC3 1 and 2, I believe they are, which change conformation once autophagy is activated. And Becklin is the other Right here. Becquerel is the other most important protein that does it sort of carry out the function, the process of autophagy. And I put mitophagy in here to illustrate the point that when autophagy is involving mitochondria, the new name for it is mitophagy. Basically, it's the mitochondria undergoing autophagy. And signals are usually the hypoxia, MPT, or uncoupling. When there is uncoupling in the mitochondria, especially change in membrane potential, that's the big one for mitochondria, mitophagy to occur. Autophagy and cancer. Now, autophagy can play in these different pathways. I usually don't like to read my slides, so I will leave you guys to it. If you have any questions, I think that's it. Let me know. I know there's an exam on Thursday, so you guys probably don't have any questions, but if they do come up after the exam, let me know. I think my email is in there, and I will send you that extra slide again.